This is Arts Alive for this Saturday, March 11th. I'm Brian Lauritsen. On the program today, music. It's great. But a visit to the concert hall surrounded by strangers, all of you united by the experience of a live performance, that's greater than great. And when that live performance is an opera, get ready for an entire emotional journey.
The singer can portray these emotions. They can transmit an energy. They have an aura, a presence on stage. Seeing a live performance, it really opens your eyes and you really can feel the emotions of the character, not just listen to the beautiful music.
That's soprano Golda Berkman. Her sophisticated understanding of the power of live performance is all the more impressive when you know she's still a senior in high school. Also on the program today, the incredible performances of the future depend on teaching the children of today how to play and enjoy music. We talked to Felice Mancini from the Mr. Holland's Opus Foundation about how that organization is partnering with KUSC to get instruments into small hands. Plus, film critic Kenneth Turan is with us to talk about a plague of island monsters taking over the big screen. And on Ask the Dean, does learning to play a piece of music make an imprint on the brain? Dean Rob Cudietta of the USC Thornton School of Music has the answer. First, here's Alan Chapman with the week's arts news.
From the arts desk today, Kaufman in and out at the Met. L.A. is up there in the conductor rankings and an orchestra debut half a century in the making. The Metropolitan Opera announced that German tenor Jonas Kaufmann would perform in the company's highly anticipated new production of Tosca next season. But this week, Kaufmann announced he would not. He said in a statement that he's limiting future engagements outside of Europe so he can spend more time with his children who live in Germany. Met General Manager Peter Gelb told the New York Times, "I respect his feelings. It just would have been nice if he'd come to that decision a little bit earlier, before we announced the season." Kaufmann told Gelb he was willing to sing four performances of Tosca, but he would need to skip rehearsal and the New Year's Eve gala premiere. Gelb said those stipulations were beyond what he thought was reasonable, and Vittorio Grigolo will replace Kaufmann in Tosca. Los Angeles is getting some love from Gramophone magazine's list of the 50 greatest conductors of all time. The LA Phil's Gustavo Dudamel made it to number 12 on the list. Congratulations. Several other conductors who spent podium time in L.A. are there as well. Carlo Maria Giulini, Otto Klemperer, Sir Neville Mariner, Zubin Mehta, and Sir Simon Rattle. Who came in at number one? Claudio Abbado, followed by John Barbaroli at number two, and Daniel Barenboim at number three. And pianist Reggie Dreyer made his orchestral debut this week at age 74. His lunchtime performance with South Africa's Cape Town Philharmonic won him a standing ovation. Dreyer had auditioned with the orchestra back in 1960 as an 18-year-old piano prodigy, but because Dreyer is black, the apartheid laws prevented the orchestra from offering Dreyer a position. After spending his career as a music teacher, Dreyer decided to audition again, and at the concert this week, he played the same Mozart concerto he auditioned with in 1960. That's the arts news for Saturday, March 11th. On this date in 1818, a novel with a life of its own was published. Mary Wollstonecraft, her future husband Percy Shelley, and some of their friends decided to have a competition to see who could write the best horror story. Mary had recently traveled through Germany close to the Frankenstein Castle, and she and her travel companions had been talking about alchemy, occultism, and human experiments using electricity. She dreamed about a scientist who responded with horror after creating life and started to write the story that would become Frankenstein. For Arts Alive, I'm Alan Chapman.
This is Arts Alive on Classical KUSC. How do you create the musicians and classical fans of tomorrow? For many local schools, just getting access to instruments is hurdle number one, and it's a big one. Enter the Mr. Holland's Opus Foundation. And KUSC is proud to be partnering with this foundation for our very first on-air instrument drive. We're collecting lightly used instruments from now until March 19th. And the Mr. Holland's Opus Foundation is helping us to distribute them. KUSC's Gail Eichenthal spoke to Mr. Holland's Opus Foundation President and CEO Felice Mancini about the foundation's roots and inspiration.
the movie, Mr. Holland's Opus, was very inspiring, about a music teacher affecting generations of young people in his music classes. And the man who wrote the score to the film, Michael Kamen, he started the foundation after having this experience. And he realized that it wasn't just the story in the movie, it was a real kind of endemic problem around the country. And he grew up in New York and had music freely given to him, and he felt the need to give back and to make sure that kids growing up had the same opportunities he did, you know, in school. So he was very motivated and very inspired, and he was a visionary anyway. And so he started the foundation, and I think its success, this is 20 years ago, we're working on our 21st year now in existence, but, you know, I believe that his focus just on the musical instrument part of it was kind of key to our success, because what we found over 20 years is the teachers, that's the one thing, it's the most expensive part of a music program, and the teachers just aren't given the budgets for it. So we help in a very necessary area, and this is my 19th year with the foundation, and I couldn't imagine any more gratifying work for myself.
Well, there's a wonderfully concrete aspect to what you do with the Mr. Holland's Opus Foundation, which is literally put instruments into the hands of kids at public school music programs. Michael Kamen himself, a graduate of New York's famous High School of Music and Art, a public school, and your father, the great composer Henry Mancini, also attended a public high school in Pennsylvania.
West Aliquippa, he would tell you. West Aliquippa, Pennsylvania. And believe me, I have been to the school. I saw where he grew up and where he went to school. And I believe that if he had not had music, and teachers to encourage him and build his confidence at that point in his life, we would never have all the music that he left us with. So he had during his lifetime, he loved working with young people, and he really felt that music education was vital and really key to opening all sorts of doors.
So this particular instrument drive that KUSC is privileged to be partnering with the foundation on involves music drop-off sites, instrument drop-off sites all over Southern California. Tell us a little about that.
Well, it does, and we're covering all of your listenership, and it goes all the way from Santa Barbara down to San Diego, and we have 12 sites all there, conveniently located for people all up and down the coast to drop off their instruments. So it's between a combination of coffee houses and music stores. We're kind of covering a range of interests and locations. So we're trying to make it as convenient as possible. And then for those people who might live in the San Fernando Valley, our office is located there. So we're happy our door is open, and we've been flooded with instruments already. So we're getting off to a really great start, and we're very encouraged and happy to get the community involved. I don't think people really understand the need for this, and believe me, I understand how difficult it is to let go of a musical instrument that you used to play. It's a very emotional thing, and people work hard to play instruments, but if they're just sitting there unused, just imagine giving that instrument life again, and especially to a kid who would never, ever be able to afford it or rent it. You know, the kids that we help in these schools are really low-income kids, and we're trying to give them access to all the tools and opportunities that kids a little more privileged have. And, you know, it's really important. Music can be a real gateway to great things and opportunities for these kids. And so I think if you just realize that every instrument has a story, and we can continue the story.
The foundation vets these programs, don't they? You really try to make sure that not only are the instruments in great repair and usable on day one, which is also very expensive, but that the programs are worthy.
Well, we do vet them pretty thoroughly. And, you know, we need to make sure that there's a strong curriculum and a good teacher and that the program is supported. We find programs that have at least 3 years under their belts with support of the principal and the district and you know, strong, healthy programs, because then they enroll more kids, and the more kids, you need more instruments. We find programs where they can be used immediately, and we give the schools really good instruments that the kids are going to sound good on, build their confidence, realize they can actually play something the way it's supposed to be played and hear it the way it should sound. So we work very, very diligently to find schools that are ready to accept these things and have the kids waiting in the wings.
How rewarding this must be for you to be 20 years, going on 20 years with this foundation, doing something so, again, so concrete, so practical on behalf of connecting kids to music.
I'm grateful every day of my life that I found this work. You know, I had a very fortunate family situation, and they not only instilled music in my life, I mean, that's, I think, genetic, but they also gave me a real sense of philanthropy and giving back. And so this really combines things that I hold very dear as far as my own personal values. And so to combine these things, I just feel that I couldn't do anything better in my life.
Felice Mancini is the president and CEO of the Mr. Hollins Opus Foundation. She spoke with KUSC's Gail Eichenthal. And for more about the instrument drive KUSC and the foundation are hosting, you can visit our website at kusc.org. For more information about the foundation, visit mhopus.org. You're listening to Arts Alive on Classical KUSC. I'm your host, Brian Lauritsen. Still to come on today's program, soprano Golda Berkman explains why she won't be singing Tosca anytime soon. But first, LA Times and Arts Alive film critic Kenneth Turan joins KUSC's Gail Eichenthal to talk about a new take on an old monster.
King Kong has this great cinematic tradition, and we're back with Kong Skull Island. The director, Jordan Vogt Roberts, tell us about it.
King Kong is one of my favorite guys. He's big and he's strong, but he's sensitive and he has issues. And, you know, he's very much of a modern person. And, you know, the first Kong was 1933. And periodically there have been new versions. There was one with Jessica Lange, and then there was one with Naomi Watts. And now we have the new one with Brie Larson. And it's Kong Skull Island. And that kind of means that there's a lot of other monsters around. Sometimes that's a good thing, sometimes not.
Uh-oh. This also stars Tom Hiddleston, Samuel L. Jackson. There's a role for John Goodman, so it's a really fun cast. And Brie Larson off of her Best Actress Oscar. So how does it come together?
I don't know if there's going to be any acting Oscars involved for anyone in the cast this time around. It's kind of a lively film initially. It's got a funny idea. It's set in 1973 at the tail end of Vietnam. John Goodman is kind of the mad scientist who thinks that there's all these monsters on Skull Island, and it turns out that it's true. But, you know, there, for my taste, there's a little too many monsters. There's a little too much grotesque monster action. I'm probably in a minority here. I mean, I think we live in a world where you can't have too much grotesque monster action. King Kong himself was created by ILM, and very realistic Kong, got a lot of close-ups of his face. Kong is everything you'd want him to be. The rest of the film, with some exceptions, there's John C. Reilly has a role, a very amusing role, as someone who's been stranded on Skull Island. Who knew? You know, so there's things to like about the film, but finally it kind of devolves into all monsters all the time, and there are all these monster battles, and I kind of got monstered out.
Okay. Let's turn to a great local tradition, which is the 2017 UCLA Festival of Preservation runs for nearly a month, already underway at the Billy Wilder Theater in Westwood. And I'm sure you have some favorites to recommend.
Well, there's stuff every weekend. I mean, as you say, it's a month-long festival. This is stuff that UCLA itself has preserved, often from elements that are gathered from far corners of the world. UCLA is one of the great preservation archives in the entire world. And this is where they get to show off. They get to show the interesting things that they've preserved. And just, you know, this weekend is almost picked at random. There's a film called The Mad Game, Saturday night. An early Spencer Tracy role. He's very young and violent. He plays an interesting kind of bootlegger and a bad guy. So it's fun to see him so young. And then on Sunday night, there is kind of a B-picture double bill. One of the things they focused on this year at the festival is kind of these B-pictures, these programmers, these kind of films that even in their day were not considered worthy of much notice. There's one called SOS Tidal Wave from 1939, which is not only about television news, it's about fake news on television, the power of fake news, you know, decades ahead of what we're dealing with now. And it's on a double bill with a film called False Faces, which is a real potboiler. It's based on a true story of a doctor who decided to do plastic surgery and didn't know a thing about it. And that didn't stop him. And they finally caught him. He goes to trial. And all kinds of shenanigans and crazy stuff happens. Again, these are real harum scarum films. They are not the Oscar films of their day. They were just the bottom half of the double bill, but they're a lot of fun.
I want to mention the following weekend, fabulous jazz programming, George Shearing, Nancy Wilson, and recorded live performances celebrating Laurel and Hardy on the 18th, and so much more. I want to call our listeners' attention to the website where they can find out what's going on the whole month, cinema.ucla.edu/events. Thanks for the good word.
Well, thank you. You know, I get emails from friends all across the country when this happens. It's every 2 years. I say, we wish we could be in L.A. for this. It's a great event.
L.A. Times and Arts Alive film critic Kenneth Turan with KUSC's Gail Eichenthal talking about the 2017 UCLA Festival of Preservation. The website is cinema.ucla.edu. They also dished the dirt on Kong Skull Island, out now in wide release. You're listening to Arts Alive here on Classical KUSC. I'm Brian Lauritsen. I hope you'll join us next week when we talk to two of our era's most talented pianists. Emmanuel Ax and Genevieve Thibaudet will be on the program next Saturday morning at 8 here on Arts Alive. And you can listen to archived episodes of Arts Alive anytime with the Arts Alive podcast, which you can find at kusc.org. Coming up, we ask the dean, but first, soprano Golda Berkman has performed at the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion, on stage at the Broad Stage, and at Carnegie Hall and Walt Disney Concert Hall, and as Loretta in Redlands Opera Theater's production of Gianni Schicchi. She sang one of opera's most epic arias, O Mio Babbino Caro. And with a resume like that, you might be surprised to hear, well, she's still in high school. Berkman has a special concert coming up on March 17th, and she spoke with KUSC's Kelsey McConnell to talk about that and about her first exposure to the art form that is becoming her career.
I was 4 years old. I saw Mozart's Magic Flute, and I was in awe of everything. I was in awe of the sets, you know, when Tamino is playing the flute and all the animals are following him. I just loved it. And since then, I started listening to more classical music. I felt that there was a true artistry that I recognized, and I really loved that from a young age for some weird reason.
One thing I've heard from other singers about why opera specifically appeals to them, and also maybe why it's been so enduring, is that it brings together so many art forms. There's music, obviously, but then there's also a story, which means there's acting and all the visual aspects of the costumes and the sets. Do you like being around all those different creative forces?
Yes, I think all of those creative forces are very important. In my opinion, I think that acting is one of the most important components of opera singers and opera in general, because, as you said, it's a story, it's a plot, it's kind of like a movie with constant music and singing. So I feel as though when artists truly know what they're singing about and they can portray that, it would be an incredible opera to watch, and the audience really can love and feel a part of it.
For a young singer like yourself, what do you think it's really important to learn? Technique, repertoire, history, how not to be nervous in front of an audience?
Well, I think that actually the most important thing to learn is how to portray the emotions of the character, how to portray not just in a vocal way, but in an emotional way, how you stand on the stage, how your eye focus, your hands. I think that when you really have someone who knows what they're saying and you can see the energy in their hands and their eyes and their body, I feel as though that the audience feels it as well. So I think that's the most important thing.
How important do you think is life experience when it comes to bringing those deeply emotional roles to life?
It's definitely important. And for me, being such a young singer, there are some roles right now that I can't. I can sing vocally well, yes, but I can't really give that extra emotion. I can't give that extra energy that someone who had or has had those life experiences could do as well. So yes, I think life experience is a very important thing. For example, I'm not going to be going singing Tosca tomorrow, even though I love the role. I haven't had that feeling yet, so I can't really truly jump into it.
Well, you're about to get a lot of life experience. Your concert on March 17th is sort of a farewell concert. You're going to graduate from high school in June, and then you're off to Italy.
Yes.
What will you be doing there?
I'm going to be studying in an academy in Rome, and I'm going to be studying opera. I already speak pretty well the Italian language, so that's fine. I'm going to be also studying acting and just stage presence and the history of opera.
Was it hard for you to decide what to do next after graduation?
It really was for a while, because for a long time I had this dream of going to traditional music conservatory, and I had that opportunity. But then for some reason, I didn't feel like it was right. I felt, you know, it's like one of those things where even though it's an incredible opportunity and you feel like it's great, there's a little voice in the back of your head that's saying, I don't know about this. So I said, I'm going to put this on the back burner. And when I looked and I searched Italy, the option just came right there. And I was so shocked at how easy everything came.
Is the Italian opera repertoire specifically something that you especially gravitate toward?
Yes, I love Italian opera repertoire.
So the concert on March 17th is a special concert for a couple of reasons. Tell me what you'll be singing.
I'm going to be singing all of my favorite arias and my favorite duets, and also the pieces that I feel as an audience member attracts me the most, and that I feel like I will get the melody stuck in my head. I feel as though those are the pieces that draw the audience the most, like Mi Chiamano Mimi. The tenor, Landon Shaw II, will be singing Una Furtiva Lagrima, which I think is probably, if I wasn't a soprano and I can magically become a tenor for a day, I'd sing that as much as I can. We're going to do the Nemorino Nadina duet from Elisir d'Amore. And we're also going to do the Mimi e Rodolfo Suave Fanciulla duet. We will have an incredible orchestra, Hollywood Chamber Orchestra, and they will be playing La Forza del Destino overture, which is my favorite overture, and also William Tell. So it's going to be great.
And this concert is also a benefit.
Yes. It's going to be benefiting St. Monica Catholic Church's efforts in Nairobi, Kenya, more in the slums of it, which is called Danbora. And it's for a hospital for women and children, mostly for maternity purposes. It's not easy for the women in the community to find hospitals where they can give birth or they can have child care. And they also help with, because HIV and AIDS is unfortunately a more major issue over in Kenya. So they help how it cannot be contracted to the fetus.
When you're talking to people who've never been to an opera before, what do you tell them about what to expect or why they should actually get to a live performance?
Well, I tell them that there's a certain relationship between the singer and the audience member. And the singer can portray these emotions. They can transmit an energy. They have an aura, a presence on stage. And it, as an audience member, it can hit you like, you know, a bag of rocks. But I feel as though seeing a live performance, it really opens your eyes and you really can feel the emotions of the character, not just listen to the beautiful music. So I think it's very important for people to see live opera.
Best of luck to you. Thank you so much for talking to us today.
Oh, thank you. It's my pleasure.
You can hear soprano Golda Berkman, along with tenor Landon Shaw and the Hollywood Chamber Orchestra, conducted by Anthony Parnthner, next Friday, March 17th, at St. Monica Church in Santa Monica. Proceeds benefit the New Dawn Hospital in Kenya, and tickets are available at stmonica.net and at all Earth Cafe locations. And Berkman spoke with KUSC's Kelsey McConnell. Now here once again is Gail Eikenthal with a question about making music stick for Dean Rob Cudiera of the USC Thornton School of Music.
Dean Rob Cudiera, so great to have you back at the KUSC studios.
It's so great to be back.
We have a question today from Thomas, who is a pianist as well as an academic advisor, and he recently reconnected on Facebook with somebody that he accompanied many years ago. He says they've agreed to get together and play the same darn piece that they did at her senior recital. He got the score, started practicing, and was amazed at how quickly the notes came back to him. When one learns a piece of music, Thomas wants to know, what kind of long-term imprint does it make on the brain as it relates to memory and physical execution?
What he hits upon is so clearly is what's commonly called muscle memory and or kinesthetic memory, and it's very, very, very powerful. So he's right that we have specific skills that once they're ingrained, they come back very, very quickly. Playing an instrument is certainly one of those. People are often amazed that when they come back to an instrument, especially piano, especially instruments that you know, guitar, violin, that you have these specific muscle movements, they do come back very quickly because there's not a lot of other motions we do that actually interfere with that. So if we learn certain patterns early on, they're going to stick with us. Same thing, not just in playing instruments, but, you know, for example, things we do all the time, like turn on a light switch. They're always the same height. We're very used to doing that. Our muscles just are used to that. Stepping on the brake in a car. These are things that become so automatic because we've done them over and over and over. And this is the reason that we have piano teachers, for example, or really all music teachers, spend so much time on scales and different etudes and exercises. Because those, it's not that people are going to sit down and play scales as, you know, for somebody to listen to, but that has certain motions in it that you're going to use over and over and over. So when you're playing and you actually find it in a real piece of music, your fingers already are comfortable and they know how to do that. This has great implications for how you learn instruments, because one of the things about muscle memory is it's really dumb. It's gonna learn whatever the world you play. So if you are learning something and you learn it wrong, the muscle memory doesn't say, oh, that's not right. That's supposed to be a B natural there. It just learns it that way. And you really have to unlearn it. So it's very important to not learn it wrong. It also has a very practical implication. So often you'll see a student playing and they hit a wrong note, and especially young children. And the first thing that the parent or the teacher says is, oh, that's the wrong note, and the child corrects it. Well, what they've just learned is to play the wrong note followed by the correct note. So they're never going to get it right. So they have to, when you're correcting a mistake, you actually have to back up and do it the right way, and you've got to do it over and over and over, because even doing it once, there's a little bit of a trace there, so you've got to get it out of the system. So two things come into play. First of all, doing the exercise over and over and over until it's so comfortable and so natural, and then not having other things that interfere with it. We tend to not have other things that would interfere. We don't have motions like we do on piano, for example, in our daily life. It's going to stay there. It's going to stay there your whole life, and will come back surprisingly quickly.
You discovered an old book that still rings true.
There's an old book that I remember when it came out, I was asked to review it for a magazine, and I loved it then. And I still had it on my shelves from 1986, and it's called Tone Deaf in All Thumbs. And it's called
my autobiography.
Yeah. It's called An Invitation to Music Making for Late Bloomers and Non-Prodigies by Dr. Frank Wilson. And so I went back to that book, and I was surprised, really, how well it's held up. It's really a delightful book. And if somebody's interested in this, or if somebody's learning to pick up an instrument late in life, that's a really, really good book to look at. I still recommend that. Very readable and a fun book. I assume it's still available somewhere.
All right. Well, this sounds actually quite encouraging. Thank you. Thank you, Dean Rob. Yeah. And thanks, Thomas, for bringing up the question.
Do you have a question for Dean Rob Kudieta and his team of experts at the USC Thornton School of Music or the Gloria Kaufman School of Dance? Music or dance? Email your questions to askthedean@kusc.org. Once again, that's askthedean@kusc.org. The technical director of the program is Mark Hatwan. Kelsey McConnell is the executive producer. We had help this week from KUSC's Alan Chapman and Gail Eichenthal. Thanks also to Sheila Tepper. I'm Brian Lauritsen. Have a great weekend.